I realized that I was like in the shower,
Thank you, everyone, for coming to the council meeting. Today is Monday, February 23rd. We are going to start with introductions. So if we can start with me.
I think I'm in call room.
Oh, we're going to get one.
Then I'm Chuck Adams.
Here.
Robert Arnold is excused. Erwin Bios.
Right.
Here.
Phil Bloom.
Here.
Anna Franzuela.
Here.
Franklin Montello Wade. Ed Cleese is excused. Zachary Davenport is on an LOA. Lee Flores.
Present.
Elise Griffin. Jesus is excused. Ron Fernandez.
Here.
Lee Jewell.
Present.
Thomas Noble will be joining us later. Now me. DJ Lee Miyake.
Here.
Alex Lynn is on an LOA. Derek Mack. Marco Montenegro. Jan Oskarsson is also on the LOA. Irma Prada,
here.
Charles Rump. JP Soto.
Here.
Richard Sullivan is also on the LOA. Laura Cavins. And Manuel Vasquez is excused. One more time, I'll go through those who may have joined. Elise Griffith. Now me. Derek Mack. Marco Montenegro. Charles Rome. And Laura Thomas. All right. And then, as the chair, Council staff.
Council staff. Members of the
Brendan Gove with Ownership Technologies. Stephen Spano, HCAP attorney at the AZ Legal Referral Panel.
Hi, I'm Emily Ragnall, and the acting director of Population Behavioral Health with PHS.
Perfect, thank you.
Do
you have a couple more on
there? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. And if we can do the remote, I'm so sorry that I skipped. Why don't we start with Mark?
Hi, Mark Mulroy, Council Staff. Sorry, I'm not there, everyone. I'm not sick today.
Leroy?
Hello, my name is Leroy Blea. I'm the Ending the Epidemics Program Manager. Hello to everybody today.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to actually introduce my colleague, Michael Freeman, from the California Department of California DHCS. So, Michael, just go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi everyone, Michael Freeman. I'm the Assistant Deputy Director for Healthcare Benefits and Eligibility at DHCS.
Thank you.
Hi, Natalie, DPH, HHS.
I think it's Nico, right? Yeah, it's Nico. Nico? Nikos, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Tell me something new.
You're on mute, Nikos. We'll get back to Nikos. So, why don't we have Lauren please about?
Lauren Thomas, council member. Perfect. And then Anna?
I'm a community health executive. Thank you. Nikos?
Oh, it's Nikos. Nikos is here. We are going to review and approve schedule with my third draft again. The agenda and revision changes. There are some things to be. Hearing that, well, for the recommendation. We are going to review and approve January 28th draft minutes.
Can you guess it up?
I am there.
Hi there, thank you. Do you see any changes, additions to the agenda? I'm sorry, is there anyone? Hearing none, we'll further by consent. Do we have any announcements? Any announcements from the remote people that are joining us? Any announcements from the public?
Just want to introduce myself again. Rick and Yolo for Sure Technologies. I'm the account manager for the State of California.
Any public comments? Any staff announcements?
Yeah, announcement is just a reminder to fill out the survey. I will be passing these out during the break. Council members, if you fill them out and have a batch with, we do go over them and review all of the survey responses during the steering. We do get looked at.
More announcements from Mark?
Mark
shaking his head no.
No, all right.
None for me, thanks.
Right, thank you. We are going to hear a general update. Bill Bloom is going to review.
Sure, so just two things. I thought I would give you all a break from me going on about that situation. but I didn't think. You know, it's a little bit tricky with so many things coming and going, but I do want to highlight to you guys and hear some input. So you remember I had mentioned that likely there was going to be a change in the formula allocation for Ryan White Part A and Part B. We haven't officially heard that, but we did hear from the staff and have that that is the plan. Do you guys kind of remember those? I really don't think able would show what's going on about $500,000 per year for the next 5 years for about $2.5 million. I think probably it's important that we start to do the planning for that. You all have heard. heard, you know, their happiness work with the mayor. The mayor, I think, somewhat before with the director of the Department of Public Health, kind of factor that in. I think you're also aware that with the surplus rebate and right away Part B from the pharmaceuticals, that that could be another way that these dollars are backfilled. However, I think probably that we're not thought of that. But if we should start to have some conversations, and we will have modeling, assuming that we base what you guys did, put in for a reduction. As you all recall, when we did the priority allocation, we said if there was a reduction, disproportionately for the core services and for the support services. So we'll share that model for you with the hope it will be an academic exercise. And of course, we want to hear also about the general fund. You all know we don't necessarily have to purview over that, but at least at this point, the San Francisco Health Network leadership is very interested in what this group has done, potentially applying to going to contract with general fund. So I realize I'm giving you a whole lot of generalities, and I'm sorry that I can't give us one path, but I think it's probably important that we start to do some planning for a couple of different generalities. And I'll stop there to see if anyone has any questions.
You're going to do the modeling and then you submit that to Mark, and we'll have that put into the agendas.
I think again, I'm guessing they're not even going to get their report out to us for a couple, 3 months. And, you know, of course, if the new board is getting into the contract here, as we've done in the past, we don't mess with people's contracts until we know what the numbers are. So we continue the contracts running forward, and then we absorb the reduction or the addition within the remainder of the contract years, but I think we'll still use the process. Again, it's a little added down because we're going to be giving you projected numbers, not the actual ones. So, but I think we'll give you a magnitude of scale. So in terms of the plan, I think we'll share the information, give you guys maybe a month to digest it and ask questions, have thoughts about it, and then we'll kind of that forward. That's my original thought. I haven't had a chance yet to speak to the co-chairs and stuff to see if people want stuff differently. But if you guys would like a different process, I think that they would need to let Mark know or let the co-chairs know. We'll figure out if we can start the process sooner. Again, I don't know if this is going to be an academic exercise or a real one. Welcome to working in PDH. You guys are all honoring PDH. any more questions on that? Now, a little more, somewhat more fun news. So every other year, the Ryan White programs hold the national conference. And the other year, they hold what's called a reverse site visit. So the conference is going to be happening this year from August 2nd through 4th or 5th. It's in D.C., beautiful, fabulous D.C. weather. But there is interest in having, as possible, one unaffiliated consumer. So that means even if you are a consumer, if you are HIV positive, you consume some service but work in an agency, you don't fall in that category. So it really is to see if it, also there's a requirement for the administrative person from the planning council to come, as well as co-chair to come. So but there is also this year an invitation to affiliate consumer. The only catch is here. Could have the money approved, maybe up to the mayor's office, but why have to start now? It's not a requirement. But if anyone is interested, they should. It's okay. Are you guys, the planning council support, okay to know about it? And if there's more than one person, then we'll kind of figure out. So if you are interested, let your pad know, let's say by tomorrow, we'll to get this, just to be supplied. And if anyone have any questions about that?
So we're going to come back to Thomas and he arrived. So
we can go over. Sure. Not much has changed. There's still only a partial budget that's been passed. There's a partial shutdown still because the Congress hasn't reached an agreement at DHS funding, the Department of Homeland Security. So because of that, there's going to be a delay in the start of the fiscal year 2027 appropriations negotiations. That's going to be held up until the full budget is approved. And that will include the expected release of the president's budget request to Congress for fiscal year 2027. That will also be delayed. Any questions? I'll update you as soon as you know more.
Okay. Leroy, if you can kind of provide us with your update.
Sure. Once again, my name is Leroy Blea, and I'm the Part B representative to the Planning Council. I have just a few short updates. The first is a reintroduction of my colleague, Michael Freeman, who is the Assistant Deputy Director for Medi-Cal Eligibility. And Michael is doing a survey of planning councils, commissions, and groups across California as he and his team's schedules allow. And once again, this is a collaboration between the Office of AIDS and DHCS to name a designated position for each planning council, commission, and group. And so Michael is scoping the duty statement for that position by observing planning councils, commissions, and groups. And that person will be stepping on to planning councils, commissions, and groups later in another quarter of the year. So if you have any questions about that, you can feel free to ask about that. And we're very happy that DHCS and Michael's team are collaborating with the Office of AIDS on this position. The other updates. We are, as you know, in collaboration with you all and eight other jurisdictions to develop a joint integrated plan. And so updates to that integrated plan are proceeding well. And the estimated timeline for where a draft will be ready for your review will be the last week of March. And we're looking to have that, community input and comments through the month of April. And we recommend that we schedule concurrence votes in each jurisdiction in May, but we could also do a concurrence presentation with you all in March. And we'll work with your staff to schedule that. Once again, a short presentation that will review the various changes of the integrated plan that we're going to be using and submitting to the CDC and HRSA as a required plan that will meet the requirement of an integrated plan for the San Francisco EMA and other jurisdictions that have joined the Office of AIDS and the California Department of Public Health in our collective action group. I presented on this before, so not a lot to update on that, except that this is a revise of the plan rather than a complete redo of the plan. And so most of the content of the plan, the San Francisco EMA and you all have approved and concurred with before. So we're doing two versions of it, one internal to California and one external to the CDC and HRSA in language that CDC and HRSA is able to accept due to policy and funding, policy changes really that have happened at the federal level. The Ending This Endemic Symposium that we have each year is going to be held September 29th through October 1st from 12 to 4. This is a virtual symposium that is open to all providers and actually anybody that is a Syndemic partner across the state. We usually draw about 500 people to that event. A lot of folks with lived experience show up. We have sessions in both English and in Spanish. And we have a pretty sophisticated translation service that allows us to actually do presentations in Spanish so that people can choose an English option. The themes this year will be racial equity, housing first, and health access for all. So we're going to be putting out some save the date notices through our partner listserv, and you'll have an opportunity just to kind of click that and move it into your calendar when we send it out as a save the date calendar invite. A little bit early in March. And then the last update I have is the CDPH is partnering with a Health HIV to offer a PrEP navigation certification training. This is a two-part training for providers that will enhance the ability for providers to do PrEP navigation services. So this will offer a certification and this is the only national certification program that prepares providers and allied health professionals to guide community members in initiating, using, and staying engaged with PrEP care. So the dates are April 23rd, once again, and April 21st. We're going to be sending out the registration with the minutes of this meeting, but also put those in the chat. I'm happy to take any questions.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I was hoping that Thomas Noble was going to be.
Actually, I was going to comment on that. So you do have comments. I was going to do a presentation. So the check update, there are a couple of updates and a couple of updates to reduce the dissemination of CDPH to be using their materials that are on the interviews. Languages available on the website, send it out, get email and also a lot of physical copies to all the institutions to work with. And if you need any other information and support, we're also continuing as the department to respond to SVP outreach, which is here to high school, investigating treatments and education efforts. And then, there's a youth event upcoming this Saturday from 1 to 4. And this vibes for wellness and youth jams. There's information there. It's at the Academic Art and Culture Center. It's going to have a lot of great performances and youth representation, information, and also testing with food. And then this week, the test council training is happening. So you can see our new materials are up. And Mr. Ruth over there is participating for agencies. We were supporting the startup, the trans babies app with the SP testing, and we had a soft launch to the book swabs and parent testing. And the BET leadership meeting is tomorrow, and Andre Higgins. Is going to be the conversation for the project map. And then just talking more about our efforts and strategies to reach back and forth. And then there was a question about the funding cuts, post funding cuts. So I've already mentioned some general funds. So, check, we've not received any information about final decisions for the general fund cuts. The contracts that we will receive. There are four contracts that we closed in the last vote. Four amounts, so SFA and SFCHC. And then the harm reduction training institute and Liverpool City still receives the streets and all contracts. We will probably find out most what everybody else finds out with this Friday. There will be a memo sent out some of the last time. And then the health commission meeting was 4 p.m. Second comment. Last time there were 3 minutes, 100 comments to 1 minute per person. So we would recommend having two versions prepared. That was last time. I think somebody showed up. That's all I know about that. I don't know how long public comments are going to be open after.
I think the other question I have about very brief is about the $8 million kind of federal level lobbying.
So as part of the federal administration proposed pass to California, Colorado, Minnesota, Illinois, SFPHC termination letters for grants. Those are National Agency of Behavioral Surveillance and NGS and SBI. Grant for scaling up the community services in section health clinics, ships, or SDH, a branch, city clinic, invest, which is public health infrastructure grants, and then their climate grants, or building resilience against climate effects of race. There's a tender for spending water in March 12th, and then there's a here this week.
So we received both the termination letter and then the letter of document for the street for that calls. The commission, the future leadership of the communication of city attorney from the impacts of those grants, which are devastating to national surveillance, HIV and STIs, and then the future leadership of the city of the ballot table. Then last week with the Saturdayship and
So programs will be cut. Does it look like maybe this could be a cut of staffing?
So what we've been told so far is that vacant positions are part of the proposal. And I don't actually if I want to talk about it, if I'm making a decision whether to fire. We've been told that layoffs are not being recommended at this time, but I don't know.
But definitely making decisions. And as far as I know, other operational expenses are probably. I'm not seeing any. Even though if you had, I consider that $8 million cut, it was exclusively to the United States and the attorney. Attorney General, the each of both states have a lawsuit, so that suspension could expand the work of the United States to work return. So that's not really a bad question.
In addition to the $8 million engaged, there are cuts to, in particular, distance space foundation, health centers, HIV prevention, and that's around $1 million a year in additional HIV prevention services on top of the cut to PPH, and there's an additional, I think it's around $1 million a year cut to UCS as well. So the $8 million is a large chunk of the cut to San Francisco, but there's a lot more that's HIV specific beyond that. And the nonprofit organizations like SFF and SFCHC are not covered under the Attorney's General lawsuit. We were not included in that. It only covers the states, and we believe it covers the county health departments, but that's been a little uncertain as well. So for better or for worse, when the administration had to reinstate all of the grants, they reinstated the CBO grants as well as the government grants, but we're not sure exactly if that is going to continue or not. It has just been easier for them to turn it back on rather than go piece by piece. But even if the Attorney General prevailed and protect the funding to the state of California and San Francisco, Department of Public Health, San Francisco still stands to lose $1 million a year in HIV prevention services. So just for the council to be aware of the whole process.
Is there a consideration that board of the lawsuits to restore those funds?
Potentially, and so as you may know, San Francisco Based Foundation and San Francisco Community Health Center, along with number of other organizations around the country, are already suing the Trump administration over previous efforts to cut our funds over the executive orders on gender ideology and DEI. That lawsuit is currently protecting us from being cut for those reasons, but because this was the Trump administration cutting the funds for a different reason, it's unclear if we're protected by the other lawsuit. So we're fortunate to have excellent legal representation from Lambda Legal, and they are assessing all of the options within California. There are several other directly funded CBOs, including APLA Health in LA and the LA Center, and a few others that are also in the same situation. So
I'm sorry, I think I was thinking more in terms of class action. But we are not the only jurisdiction that is trying to do this with. Also, I think we've been in the land of this consideration.
Yeah, the courts made it very hard to do sort of class action lawsuits.
Yeah, the Supreme Court did that.
From the administration, yes, the CEOs that are facing these cuts are definitely the kind of not single options that you can throw out what is possible. So, it all depends on whether or not you think the courts are going to protect us from these cuts. Different question.
Thank you. And not to quote what he said, but it makes me mad to know that he thinks that it's not a priority anymore. That's why he's doing his cuts. That's what the court said that Trump and his administration was. But they shouldn't be that it's not.
I mean, the Secretary of HHS is someone who's on record saying he's not sure that HHS is positive, so that's the that's the leadership that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
Why would you want to find HIV prevention? So, anything, a bill related to this, like these, there are four states that are being targeted. They all have Democratic governors who have been very actively pushing back against the federal administration. And it's very much a targeted set of this political retribution. Opinion and not. Not based on actual
evidence,
epidemiology, public health. Mm-hmm.
Any more questions? I'm here, so.
Thanks.
So we are going to hear a presentation about overdose prevention by Emily.
Hi, I have some friends.
Perfect.
Oh,
to advance slides, just the mouse.
Yeah.
It's like next is at the top.
That'll...
There we go.
Let's do a church.
Thank you. Freaking mouse. Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Emily Ragnall. I'm the acting director of Population Behavioral Health, which is a section under Behavioral Health Services in the Health Department. And within that office sits the Office of Overdose Prevention. I actually, a very, very long time ago, worked very briefly with the Planning Council and was with the Shanti Project for about 5 years. So it's very good to see faces that I haven't seen in a very long time. And it's very nice to be here. So thanks for having me. My colleague, Rob, unfortunately wasn't able to join today. So you'll just have me.
Darn it.
Oh, shoot. Okay. So today I wanted to give an update on the DPH roadmap. This is sort of our roadmap of aligning with the mayor's Breaking the Cycle initiative and sort of our next steps as a department in addressing the behavioral health crisis and how that aligns with overdose prevention. Give some updated data related to our overdose indicators that we're watching closely as a jurisdiction, and then give some updates on some overdose prevention initiatives, many of which folks in this room are a part of. Okay. And so why are we talking about overdose prevention within the context of HIV prevention and treatment? Is there is some overlap here, right? In the last HIV epidemiology report from Bill Plumman's team, they showed a really concerning increase amongst overdose deaths for people living with HIV. It was about 10% between 2012 and 2015, grew to 13% in 2016 to 2019, and then reached 20% between 2020 and 2023. So there's an increase in overdose deaths amongst people living with HIV in San Francisco. In addition to that, in 2024, it looked like 10 new cases were among people who inject drugs, five of which were among Black African Americans, which is very concerning because we also see a lot of overdose death disparities amongst that population as well. Okay. Many folks are already very familiar with the behavioral health services of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Under this sits mental health and substance use treatment. This is what we sort of encompasses behavioral health. Our vision is that all San Francisco experience mental and emotional well-being and participate meaningfully in the community across lifespans and generations. And then the mission is to provide equitable, effective substance use and mental health care and promote behavioral health and wellness amongst all San Franciscans. So some of the things that we're looking towards is expanding critical services, improving access to this care, and increasing awareness of where to get help. So some things I wanted to call out about the Division of Behavioral Health Services is that we're the largest provider of mental health and substance use services in the city. And the majority of this is actually done through community-based organizations that are providing this direct care in the community, some of which is also provided in DPH-run clinical settings. One thing I really wanted to note is in 1 year, there were over 16,000 unique individuals that received substance use services from the Department of Public Health and Behavioral Health Services and our contractors. And then this number grows astronomically more with some of our low barrier services that are being provided anonymously. So we're not collecting identifiers to be able to duplicate those numbers. So through the health department and through our community partners, you know, we're serving a huge population of people that use drugs and are in need of substance use treatment and overdose prevention services. Soon in Mayor Lurie's administration, he announced the Breaking the Cycle initiative to address homelessness and behavioral health crisis. And so our goals within the health department is to build a more responsive and proactive behavioral health system of care that'll move people quickly from the streets into effective treatment and sustained recovery, and to reduce fatal overdoses and overdose disparities. And so some of the key activities are expanding treatment beds and services, accelerating and simplifying entries to care, support people to progress through care, what you'll often hear referred to as stickiness. So yes, people may walk in the door or get access to the care, but how do you retain them? Refining the distribution of safer use supplies. Folks are likely familiar with the policy that came out in May of last year, where restrictions were put in place on where safer use supplies could be distributed. Build a comprehensive pathway to recovery, which is really emphasizing the entire continuum of substance use treatment services and overdose prevention services, from, you know, low barrier anonymous services embedded in community to higher levels of care like withdrawal management and residential treatments, and then finally preventing overdoses. So one thing we really want to emphasize is that every overdose death is preventable and unacceptable, and our numbers have been far too high. Our deadliest year was 2023 with 810 overdose deaths in San Francisco. We saw that number reduce in 2024 to 635. And we, in January, we got the final report for calendar year 2025, and we had 621. So we are seeing a reduction, but we still have a far, far way to go. This is also replicating what we're seeing in the rest of the country as well in terms of fatal overdoses. There's a lot of information here, but what I really want to emphasize is that the majority of overdose deaths in San Francisco are involving opioids and even more fentanyl.
and that we continue to see stimulants like cocaine and methamphetamine also present amongst decedents as well. Many folks in San Francisco that are using opioids and fentanyl are also using stimulants as well. And then we continue to see horrific racial disparities related to overdose deaths. So Black San Franciscans experience overdose deaths at 6 times the rate of other races and ethnicities. We are seeing, you know, Black African-Americans are accessing MOUD treatment at a similar rate and other types of treatment services, but this disparity nonetheless continues to exist. I think in the work of HIV and any other sort of health disparities, we know that this isn't limited to one factor. It is systemic and institutionalized, and in ways to address it, we need to have some kind of institutional responses. Okay, so how are we tackling overdoses particularly? So really building on leading innovations in San Francisco, really focused on medications for opiate use disorder, which is one of our most effective treatments for substance use disorder. Having really culturally congruent targeted overdose prevention efforts in high-risk communities like the Black African-American community, and then implementing the Breaking the Cycle initiative, which is really providing more proactive and expanded treatment and recovery services. So I'm going to highlight some of the interventions that have been launched recently and give some data on those. One of the most successful has been bringing expanded access to medication, or BEAM. This initially started as a telehealth access to medications for opiate use disorder run by the health department. It's available every single day of the week from 8 a.m. to midnight. You just have to call that phone number there and press 1. Services are also available in other threshold languages. This was intended to be all through telehealth, right? Like, you can talk to a prescriber on the phone, they'll write you a prescription to your pharmacy of choice. But we realized that folks need in-person support as well. So at 1380, what the team has done is they started providing services in person with a particular focus on like navigating people through treatment. And then also a focus on long-acting injectables. So long-acting injectables, buprenorphine is a treatment of choice for some individuals. And so they are doing that there in some innovative models where they're using different dosing and things like that to make it more effective for different individuals. One thing I also really want to emphasize is MOUD for buprenorphine. We've seen a huge increase in the number of unique people that have prescribed buprenorphine in San Francisco. This increased 32% from 2023 to 2024, and then again, an additional 21% between 2024 and 2025. This is in large part due to programs like BEAM and other programs where they've made the access to buprenorphine as low as possible, and providing it in multiple different settings. A challenge that we continue to have with buprenorphine is retention. So across all patients in San Francisco that are taking buprenorphine, we see about a 30% 6-month retention rate, meaning that they're continuing to take the medication for 6 consecutive months. But what we're seeing with new patients that are just getting started and have not taken it before is that retention rate is only at about 5%. So it's much, much lower. We know that when folks are first starting a new medication or new treatment, that is often the most challenging time, right? Like accessing a new med, seeing a new provider, dealing with side effects and symptoms and finding the right dose for yourself. And that's when we often lose people. So what we're really shifting our focus to is not only starting people on these life-saving medications, but retaining them in it. So one of the tools that we're using is long-acting injectables, expanding the Restore program, which some folks may have heard of. This was at the Dante Hotel. This is where people that are interested in getting started on medications for opiate use disorder can be housed as they're getting started, connected with case management and other services. The program has since moved to the Central Waterfront Navigation Center. So now in a congregate setting instead of individual rooms, although we really hope to be able to go back to a model where folks can have individual rooms and privacy, if that's what people need and want. And then also looking at how do we use tools like contingency management and incentives to really support retention in this treatment. Next, I want to talk about methadone. So we saw a huge dip in the number of people utilizing methadone post the pandemic. Luckily, in the last year, we've seen that number increase back to pre-pandemic levels. So just over 2,000 unique individuals receiving methadone treatment in San Francisco at our various community-based methadone clinics. We also have seen that folks that are getting started on methadone are much more likely to be retained in methadone treatment as compared to buprenorphine. This has to do with like the effectiveness of it, and also because it's a higher barrier to entry, right? Buprenorphine, you can call someone right now, and if you it's medically safe for you and you qualify and all those things, clinically, you can go pick it up at Walgreens, right? Like, we've made it really, really accessible. Methadone is still in the very archaic model of you have to go to a licensed methadone clinic. You have to get directly observed treatments. We've made a lot of progress in working with the state and in response to some federal regulatory changes to really safely loosen the restrictions on methadone to make it more patient-centered and trauma-informed. So what that looks like is a quicker titration of your dose, so getting up to a therapeutic dose quicker when you're first getting started, and then also being allowed take-homes. During COVID, we gave people take-homes to methadone, and they did great. They were more likely to stay engaged in treatment, they were being safe, and so really expanding the availability of take-homes so that folks aren't forced to go to the clinic every single day. We've also done some innovative things with allowing methadone to be dispensed, not just at methadone clinics, but through this thing called the 72-hour rule, where methadone can be administered out of an outpatient setting. So we're doing this right now at the Bridge Clinic at the hospital and are hoping to pilot it at other locations as well. We've also looked at utilizing contingency management to support methadone retention. And have launched additional navigation support programs to really support people as they're getting stabilized on methadone. And then utilize something that's evidence-based in the serious mental illness or mental health realm, which is called Clubhouse model. It's actually taking that strategy and utilizing it for people that are on methadone.
Any questions?
I would say at least to the end. I have 20 slides, and sure. I want to be respectful when you guys meet. I only have a few more. So one of the programs that we launched that was really focused on being culturally responsive and providing culturally congruent care is we've partnered with Code Tenderloin to really focus on the Bayview neighborhood. You know, what we are constantly hearing from community is that DPH has really failed the Bayview, right? Like, there are not enough services there. We are not doing enough to address the needs of Black African Americans in the Bayview neighborhood. And so we launched this navigation program really focused on engaging folks in a culturally relevant way in the Bayview to access medication appropriate use disorder and other services as well. You know, we are not able to engage people into treatment if their immediate needs aren't addressed. So Code Tenderloin is doing a wonderful job supporting people in accessing housing, food, hygiene, other things that may be more immediate needs, as well as medications for opiate use disorder. In the first 3 months in the Bayview, they connected 170 individuals to medications for opiate use disorder in the Bayview. And they're working closely with the OTOP Bayview Van, as well as Bayview Hunter Point Foundation. And Bayview Hunter Point Foundation also offers a range of other services, mental health services for families and parents as well. They're also using that telehealth line. And they're also working closely with like Mother Brown's Kitchen, the Bayview Navigation Center, to like engage people in their environments where they feel safe accessing services. The SHOP is another program that we're really excited about. This will be launching the first week in March. So next week, they will be doing their ribbon cutting. So the SHOP is based on a barbershop model. We have seen this be effective at addressing cardiovascular disease among Black African Americans. And so we're launching this through the lens of overdose prevention. And so Glide will be operating a barbershop where folks can come in, get grooming services, meet with case managers, be connected to other treatment services, and really creating third space and like community space for people to come together focused on Black African American men in particular, because they are experiencing the worst of the worst disparities. I think these hours aren't quite finalized yet. They're still fleshing it out, but will be released next week when we officially do the ribbon cutting, but they'll be open 6 days a week, so including Saturdays, and having some evening hours as well. Contingency management is another program that we've really looked to expand over the last year. Programs like the San Francisco AIDS Foundation Prop Program has been around for a very long time and has done amazing work. And, you know, we started with that one program many years ago, now have grown to close to 15 programs and are hoping to grow even more. And also looking at utilizing contingency management, not just for people who use stimulus, but people who use opioids as well. So I want to highlight three programs: the Gubbio Project and the Mission in partnership with DPH and the San Francisco AIDS Foundation launched the first Spanish language contingency management program that was incredibly successful late last year and are looking to launch the next cycle shortly. The San Francisco AIDS Foundation late last year launched Prop Empowerment, which again was focusing on providing culturally congruent treatment services to Black African Americans. And then finally, GLIDE late last year launched a program focused on really low barrier access to contingency management services as well. Some folks may have already heard about this, but I really want to highlight some of the bed expansion that the health department has been able to do with partners, one of which is 822 Geary, which is a former Goodwill site in the Tenderloin that is now a stabilization unit. So just providing a little bit of data on some of the outcomes here. So they've had 543 admissions between April and November. They're serving about 16 people at a time. They're also doing a lot of work to expand referrals and have stronger referrals with inpatient psych and psychiatric emergency services. And then also working to really ensure that clients that are leaving the stabilization unit are connected to ongoing care. A couple other bed expansion things that I want to highlight is we've already talked about 822 Geary. We've also launched 21 withdrawal management beds at Harbor Lights in partnership with Salvation Army. There's also 72 non-congregate respite sites in partnership with Westside at the Eleanor Fagan Center. 62 recovery housing sites at Wells Place, again, in partnership with Salvation Army. 27 emergency stabilization unit beds that were opened in December of 2025. And then we've also expanded our beds through out-of-county partnerships. So if we don't have the bed availability here or the capacity to provide those services here, is using out-of-county partners to ensure that folks in San Francisco can get access to the right care. And then looking to the future, hoping to launch some locked sub-Q treatment beds next year, and then in the following 2 years, expanding dual diagnosis treatment beds. So that's for people with both a mental health and substance use disorder. And then substance use residential step-down beds. So these are long-term recovery beds for people that have gone through residential treatment, need ongoing access to care, and if they are made in records. I'm happy to take any questions. If I can't answer them myself, I may follow back up with the planning council staff to provide it. But yes, please go ahead.
I was curious about the line on slide number 15. Using new state flexibility guidelines to adapt treatment to the needs of people who use fentanyl.
Yes.
What are those state guidelines and why are they there?
Yeah, so the state regulates how we provide methadone services. So they write all the regulations that methadone programs across the state have to follow. These are informed by regulations at the federal level. So they've always been in existence, and truthfully, they were really made for the era when people were using heroin and not fentanyl. So they needed to be modernized. There's a really excellent group called Liberating Methadone that pushed a lot of this legislative changes that have allowed for more flexibility with methadone. And so those are things like take homes, having folks be rapidly induced at a therapeutic dose, and then work to get methadone out of methadone clinics and into more outpatient settings so it's more accessible to people. We're not there yet, but are piloting some small projects.
Two more quick questions. How much has the budget increased from previous years to reach these goals? And can you talk a little bit about the Reset Center? And also, are there efforts made to identify people that are HIV positive to steer them into surgeries?
Yes, I'm going to write that was a brief marker, so I just want to make sure I get the HIV, Reset, and then budget growth.
Yeah.
So in terms of budget growth, a lot of this has been funded through federal and state grants. So through CDC grants, SAMHSA grants, California Department of Public Health grants that have funded a lot of this work, as well as opioid settlement funds, both that are getting filtered through at the state level, and then settlement funds that our own jurisdiction had went into agreement with different manufacturers and pharmacies about. The determination for how those opioid settlement funds would be distributed was actually made under Mayor Breed, and then we're sort of like implementing that now, and we have specific categories in which we need to fund, like contingency management or methadone or things like that. In terms of the Reset Center, the Health Department did partner with the Sheriff's Department on the development of the Reset Center. However, I know just about as much as everyone else knows in terms of what's been in the news. It'll be run and operated by the Sheriff's Department, so they're a holder of a lot of that information. I do know that we are working with our treatment programs to ensure that folks that are going through the Reset Center have immediate access to care. And then in terms of like targeting people living with HIV, I mean, most of this work that's happening is actually happening with providers that have historically provided HIV care, and HIV testing. It's sort of, you know, even though Hannah and Thomas are in a different division of the health department, we're often funding the same providers that do the same work.
Yeah, and that's important because we don't know who we don't know.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
We have a number of topics and questions on this. And the first one is a big one. It's been quite a number of years since I've heard anything about, not in this setting, but in other settings, about medical grade heroin. And I don't know if that is ever a consideration. I know it's not a consideration in the United States, but I'm wondering, it has ever been a consideration for the department to consider medical grade heroin as an alternative to not only methadone, but also in helping mean off of use.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why overdoses occur is because we have an unregulated drug supply. And that's what makes it risky and dangerous. You know, Canada did pilot a program with Dilaudid. It's actually done through vending machines in British Columbia, using private metrics to get access to the supply. I am not aware of anyone doing that in the US. I think under this administration, they've made very clear that things like safe consumption sites and other things will absolutely not be allowed.
One of the additional questions that I have, and it sort of mirrors a little bit of what he was looking at as well. I am unaware of any work that has been done in the aging, particularly the aging men, in the male environment, in regards to substance use. In HIV, the community is quickly aging. A number of them are substance users, are becoming substance users. So I'm wondering if there is there any information
to get out? Like long-term survivors and like their interaction with substance use treatment services and things like that? You know, I truthfully I don't know enough about this. You know, again, a lot of our community providers that are serving those populations also do substitute work as well. And so I think that's one of our biggest strengths as a system is that we have longstanding, trusted community providers that do this work. And we're limited in some of the data that we have access to. This is a project that we've been working very closely with the medical examiner on. It's actually expanding their survey work and their ability to report and understand more about overdose decedents. One thing that's been done in other jurisdictions is what's called an overdose fatality review, where you actually examine each individual overdose decedent's case to get a better understanding. Of like, where did we fail? But yes, we do need a more systematic way at the aging population and there are no substitutes. I don't know, Bill, if this is something that could be done with the HIV immunology data for mortality for people with HIV, but I'd be really interested in how we could talk about it.
So I know the data studies actually have employers process for the HIV. I don't know if that's before it's published, but we can talk with William Farland to see what's happening.
One last question. I have other questions, but this is, and it's much more of a comment. I've been listening, I've got a really other suspicions, very straightforward, just it's a really good overview of the work you're doing and the work that's being planned. Really, in regards to back up African Americans, particularly African American men, the idea of looking at ways in which we can expand the individual and then be inclusive of the community as a support is. I think it's been undersold. There is a great need to bring in community. I recently had a couple of conversations with some folks that reminded me that folks don't always identify as substance users.
Yeah.
But everyone knows someone who is misusing substances in their life, and they are at an absolute loss. So what do I say? I'm not a professional. I can't help this person. And I think it behooves us to bring in community and have a discussion about, you know, this is how you help somebody.
Yeah.
This is how you help yourself. This sort of thing in ways that isn't for lack of a better term, that isn't top heavy.
Yeah.
Or like, I know what, you know, who would be that person? You're a nasty person. But more in terms of embracing where the person is and where potentially you can get it from. And that includes the sort of environmental stressors that is a part of. Someone who is misusing substances, living in an environment that is a part of the reason why you use is not a way of getting to using. But there is still a way through this sort of thing. Like, you get what I'm doing.
And thank you. And I think one thing I want to emphasize is like so much about overdose prevention is informed by the work in HIV that's been done in San Francisco over the last 30 plus years. And I think, you know, with the Black African American work in particular, like none of this was defined by me and folks at APH. This is what community told us was needed. And us trying to be responsive to that. And that's one of the benefits of opioid settlement funding is it doesn't have the same restrictions that like the California, you know, Department of Healthcare Services has in terms of like billable services and things like that, how those can be administered. So it allowed us some of that freedom to like really listen to what community wants and like provide that in a way. Yeah.
Ron is my sophomore.
I'll pass it to the state chair if you are.
Yeah,
Well, so thank you everyone for being here. I've noticed years ago that the mode of delivery was more skewed towards syringe use.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's more smoking or slightly tinted bottles of alcohol. Has there been a change in the number of overdoses between the two modes?
You know, with the overdose death data that we get through the medical examiner, is we get toxicology results, like what was present in their body, but we don't know like the mode of use for a lot of decedents, so we aren't able to make that determination of like, was this caused by, you know, like the acute overdose related to an injection or related to smoking. That's something that like we as a jurisdiction should be looking at, because the majority of people in San Francisco are smoking drugs, which is a huge win for HIV prevention, right? Less syringes, less people sharing syringes, and more people smoking, like that prevents HIV. That's wonderful disease prevention. And then Alex Kroll, who folks may know that name, he's a researcher with RTI, has done a number of recent papers on smoking in San Francisco, and data and information related to like SSP or syringe service program utilization. That also has some more information about that.
So if we could say that smoking is safer to prevent overdose, in injecting, would that be a strategy for the Department of Public Health?
You know what, I don't know if I can say that smoking is safer in terms of preventing overdose, but what I can absolutely say is smoking is safer in terms of infection.
So that is the perfect setup, I think, for my question,
yeah.
Which is, given what you just said, that smoking is reduces HIV risk. What do you think, given that the health department is currently placing pretty dramatic restrictions on the distribution of smoking supplies in San Francisco, including to the Black African American community, what does DPH think is going to be the impact on HIV in terms of reducing access to the HIV?
Yeah, so to clarify on the policy, is it mandated that folks that were distributing smoking supplies in outdoor public spaces move indoors or onto private property. We supported some of the programs, particularly focused on Black African Americans in the Bayview and accessing the private space. Private property to be able to continue to provide those services, but it's still a cause of disruption. They were in a place that was well known, well trusted, and then we moved to them. You know, the mayor's office thinking around this is that smoking supplies, you know, moving that indoors provides more of a space to really focus on treatment connections and connections to care and engaging with individuals while balancing some of the concerns that have been raised around street behavior and around public drug use. And so we are very closely monitoring a number of indicators related to this policy, including HIV testing, new HIV infections, hepatitis C, skin and soft tissue infections, and admissions to our ED here, as well as a number of other things to try to understand what the impacts of this policy change are. So that if we see a concerning change, we can work on revising this policy to make sure that we're not going down the wrong track.
What would look like a concerning change there, and how would you know?
Yeah, so we're very lucky that we have really good surveillance data here in San Francisco for both hepatitis C and HIV. There's a little bit of a delay with HIV, we get testing a little bit closer to real time. Skin and soft tissue infections is a really good one because we get pretty close to real time access to that information. And then also what we're hearing from community providers, although it's not citywide, right, and we're hearing it from individual providers, is that we pull all that together and add to sort of our indicators report that we're sharing on a regular basis. And then also using folks like Alex Kroll and other community researchers and leveraging some of the existing research that is being done and surveillance that's being done amongst people using drugs in San Francisco to better understand it.
And just to tie this back to the earlier conversation about federal cuts, one of the things that is supposed to be cut is the National Behavioral survey, which is one of the single best courses that we have every 3 years around people who use drugs and their HIV risks. And so if we use that, I think we're going to be even further in the dark on it. And, it is challenging to me that the San Francisco Department of Public Health moved forward with the policy that they knew was eliminating the HIV prevention resource from communities that are vulnerable to both HIV and others. So.
And you know, we want to hear from folks. We want to hear what folks are hearing from their program participants, from their colleagues. I will share my email. They are also welcome to, you know, to reach out to the mayor's office as well, to share some of this information.
Right. I think we have time for one more question. So,
ahead. Thanks for the presentation. I'm just curious. You were saying that towards the end that there were additional beds for treatment added. Do you have any vague idea about what number of people? Not that you're turning them away, but there's not space for them to go at any time for treatment. And is that information being presented to the current administration at City Hall? Because so many of the political promises he's made is predicated on the fact that, like, he's going to lay a magic wand on all substance use and homelessness.
Great question. I think folks may already know about the Treatment on Demand Coalition, as well as the annual Treatment on Demand report that the Health Department is finishing or is about to finish last year's report, and getting ready to publish that and report it out to the Board of Supervisors. That gives information on the Treatment on Demand legislation and how San Francisco is doing it, implementing that, just essentially the idea that treatment should be available on demand. There's various tools that are used within the health departments to measure that. But something that we've recently launched is working with all of our programs that provide safer use supplies that are being mandated to send people to treatment, because we're actually asking them to tell us anytime that they're not able to access treatment. And we're using that in real time to actually address some policy issues for treatment providers. So things like pets, which is a never-ending problem, and always a challenge, but partners, smoking, like so many different things that are sometimes so incidental and you think small, but then you realize that it's impacting so many people. And so the more information that we get from people that are having like real in the moment challenges in accessing treatment, the better, because that's how we try to implement changes to address it. And like the more beds, the better. And I'm happy that we're, you know, expanding out of county, which I know seems, you know, counterintuitive, but it does get us access to beds that, like, our hospitals don't have the space to provide.
But do you have any numbers on that?
I don't know off the top of my head. I may have to reference the treatment demand report. It does happen, right? People are turned away. And that's why we're trying to build more and more beds, and also of the beds that we do have, expand their staffing capacity so that intakes don't just happen in the morning, they can happen in the afternoon, or they can happen on the weekends.
Just wanted to let, of course, the Biden Council know that many, many years ago, we actually funded HIV treatment back in the day when it was mostly people using heroin. And there was a real need for that just because people just weren't physically well enough to actually were residential treatments.
Mm-hmm.
We then hit a moment where there was going to be a lifetime cap housing service in 2 years, which was going to include substance use treatment. So we very quickly, with the Fighting Health Support, switched that over to general fund because we were already getting cuts. And then for a number of years, we kind of co-led with what was at that point called CDHS, now it's DHS. And then over the years, thank goodness people were just more able to endure. The stigma never disappeared, but it did decrease. People could engage in the programs. And so kind of our strategy around that has been kind of status neutral for many, many years. So we are fortunate in that we were then able to repurpose those dollars for additional other services, or at least to absorb the cuts. And, you know, just credit to my colleagues over at the LBHS for doing it. And also, want to give you a shout out, Emily. So Emily's had one of the joyful processes of helping look at how we make our budget survive. And She's emailing me at 6:30 p.m. and I'm responding at 4:50 in the morning. So you've been the ward. Tangerine is beautiful. But just thank you for all that. Yeah, you do a tremendous job with it.
Thank you all for having me. I'll make sure my email is shared. Yes.
Well, I just for public comment. I don't think, as a public member of the public, I don't get to ask any questions, but I'll phrase it differently. I hesitate to even bring this up because I don't know what a partnership with the sheriff's office looks like. But I am concerned about the reset center, and I'm concerned that, you know, even the in the inner circle of folks that are interdepartmentally partnering don't know what's going on, because that seems to be how the sheriff's department does everything, is outside of the purview of the public. And I am curious to see how that progresses, because it bothers me that funding and resources are being shifted to approach this problem from that perspective.
Yeah.
You know, from what we know works as, you know, as public health workers. So I wonder if it's a conversation for this body to talk about how do we hold that power accountable, and are they willing to show up to one of our meetings? And if not, maybe we show up there. And I don't even know what that looks like because I can't find it online.
Yeah.
So I would just love a little bit more interdepartmental transparency on that particular project.
Totally fair. Unfortunately, I'm not part at all of the reset center, so I don't know a lot of the details on it. I know some colleagues have been involved in it in the sense of like advising on some of the medical pieces, on ensuring that people are safe while they're there, if they are withdrawing from drugs. I think there's been some public comment at the Board of Supervisors and the Health Commission as the contract has been approved. I think that has passed, unfortunately, but I imagine that there'll be more opportunities for community engagement as we get closer to that site opening. And again, like welcome folks like to reach out to, you know, mayor's office and other folks that are more involved.
Is it possible to share that reset information?
The only information I have is what's been published on the web.
No, I mean, your comments that are working.
Yeah, you mentioned we can reach out to the mayor and those people.
I went to the mayor's office. I just mean I have some like substance use addiction medicine doctors that have informed some of the strategies around the journey. But yeah, happy to share emails. I can do that after the call or after the meeting.
Or just send it to Council Support.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
6 months. I ran away. And I went to LSF. I realized I didn't work with adults.
And we'll yes,
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she moved. She's done too many She's one of our largest programs, so she's actually across the street from our office at KCC, Kelly Cullen. To deliver phone. There's a lot more independence, but it's also a harder population. They're actually more often
compared. You want me to gather people?
In a second.
We're going to start. Is there going to be?
Recently, the red circles are hard to
are we back, Irma?
The only thing I do need is I have a girl.
Jesse is going to lead us on a discussion about ending the epidemic. Welcome, Chevy.
Thank you. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you. Oh, yeah, good. Okay. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Good to see you. I think there isn't a little intro for me, so I'll just say I know a lot of you in the room, or you've seen me before for various things, but I'm Shelley Pesenti from Pesenti Consulting, and we are working with folks throughout SFDPH on a project, which I'm here to tell you about so that you have information, but also because we're going to do an exercise. We want to get input from you all as important stakeholders. And so you may have noticed when you got up during the break that like a marker appeared by your place. That was me. And so you'll be using that in a little bit. And for the folks online, I actually have a mural version of this, which you can try to have you use, but I just need someone to send the link. So we'll do that in that exercise. Okay. No, that's not working. Okay. So I'm going to not talk for a super long time today because I want to make sure most of the time is spent with you all being able to give input. But I'll give you some background of like why I'm here, what this project is, and then an update on or the information for you about the process we're going to use to update San Francisco's new epidemics plan, which is also a little bit of background. So I'll kind of present those things, then take some time for questions, and then the rest of the time will be spent having you give input around the room. Hopefully you'll be enough of a dent in your food by then that you won't mind getting up. Okay, so background. So as HCPC members, you probably are already aware, but in case you need a refresher or you haven't heard, San Francisco has an integrated sometimes it's called an integrated plan or the integrated ending the epidemics plan, which exists now. It was created into 2023 for 2024 through 2026. And it outlines HIV, hepatitis C, and STI prevention, care, and treatment activities that San Francisco as a whole it has been prioritizing and trying to focus on in order to end the epidemic, right? That's the idea. And it's 2026. And so we're starting to talk about, okay, what's the next era? What does this look like? So this plan serves several purposes. One is that the state is required to have, by HRSA and CDC, to have a plan, as I think you all know from the HRSA side of things at least, that serves as a locally specific plan. And this plan, the state is required to do it, and then San Francisco as a directly funded jurisdiction is required to do it. But we're able to satisfy that by sort of supplementing the state's required plan and saying, this is what we're doing in San Francisco, having a letter of concurrence by this group saying, yes, we concur with this being the strategy. And then that fulfills that requirement of San Francisco having to have a plan for HRSA and CDC. It's also San Francisco's way of aligning with the state's overall strategic plan for addressing HIV, Hep C, and STI. So the state, you're probably familiar with that, sometimes called the yellow plan, there's like it's lots of imagery in the yellow theme. That plan is the state's overall strategic plan, and the creation of this original plan for San Francisco was to basically look at how does San Francisco want to do the things that make sense for San Francisco that align with the state's overall strategic vision. And it just functions on its own as a roadmap, as something that San Francisco has to help guide our cities. This, of course, is not meant to supplant or otherwise ignore the important role that the HCPC plays in making decisions about where resources should be allocated. That's not what this plan is for. This plan is really to set guidance around, like, these are the things that we want to prioritize, the new things that we think will make a difference, those kinds of things. And ultimately, ideally, to be information for you all as the HCPC to make decisions about where you think things should be allocated when you all make those decisions. So it's meant to be a resource for you and others doing this work, not something that's taking the place. And so in 2026, we're looking to update the plan, and the new one will be for 2027 through 2029. And we're doing this with extensive stakeholder input, more than we did. There was stakeholder input in 2023 for the last plan, but not quite like this. We're really going all out to try to talk to as many people as possible and get as many people as possible to make this a community engaged plan, as opposed to something that's largely done within the health department, trying to sort of strategize and then tell everybody what the health department came up with. So, speaking of the health department, just so you know, when I say we're working with people throughout SFDPH, who are we really talking about? And there's basically four sections of SFDPH that receive the bulk of the federal and state Ryan White funding, CDC HIV prevention dollars, CDC STI control, hepatitis C funding, and San Francisco General Fund support for HIV, Hep C, and STI activities. And so those are there are representatives from each of those sections that we're working with closely in kind of coordinating and planning this effort. So those are ARCHES, which is the Applied Research something Epidemiology section. they do epi and surveillance. And CHEP, which I'm sure you all are familiar with, Community Health Equity and Promotion Branch, the STI HIV branch within Population Health Division, and then HHS, HIV Health Services, which is not within Population Health, it's within primary care, with that San Francisco Health Network, as I'm sure you know. So those are the folks we're really working with closely when it comes to this plan. Okay, so that's like the background, just so you know what the heck I'm even here talking about. So what is this process that we're undertaking to update this plan? This is a list of all the initial, most of the places that we're getting community engagement. So you see that HIV Community Planning Council up here, I'm here tonight having this conversation, but we're doing similar, some version of this, not necessarily exactly the same thing, but some version in all of these places that you see up here. So we've got a team of people having these conversations over and over. And giving updates, getting input from different places. And then the other big piece of community engagement, I know this is a lot of text on the slide when you're in person, when you're at home on Zoom, this isn't so bad, but in person, this is small. So I'll just tell you what it says, which is CHEP separately has funded a project to get community engagement and input from key populations that have been identified as priority populations for doing HIV, Hep C, and STI work. These are the same populations that the health access points are geared towards. And so separately, CHEP had a request for proposals to work with a group to put together this community advisory process, which you might hear me refer to as the CAP. And basically, independent from our work on the integrated plan, Placenti Consulting applied for that and was also awarded that contract. So it ended up being quite nice because we were able to integrate those two things for the first year. So there was a discussion and we basically said, okay, the CAP activity for year one, instead of any of the other things we might have been doing, let's really focus on engaging these communities around their input and what they think about the ideas for the ending epidemics plan that we're working on. And so the way it works is that Placenti Consulting is subcontracting with 7 organizations, which you see here, which were chosen specifically because of their deep connections to the different populations. So we're working with Friendship House, which works with Native American, American Indian, and Indigenous communities. Wise Health SF, working with Black and African American communities, for example. And you might notice these are not often like the most typical go-to agencies. And that was very specific for HIV, Hep C, and STI work. And that was very specific because the idea is to actually look at the HAP model, the health access point model, as part of this, and what's been working really well, and where are the places where we might want to rethink or where extra support is needed. And so the goal here was to work with organizations that have deep ties to these communities, but are not already involved in the HAP. Because if they're involved in providing the services through the HAP, it's very difficult to then do that kind of evaluation of the HAP model and what's working, right? So we specifically are partnering with organizations that aren't involved in the HAPs. And we're working with them to basically, they're going to be disseminating surveys, holding community engagement events, and doing different things with the folks in their community that they work with to get their input, to inform the plan, but then also to be able to provide information. And the goal is to reach people who aren't the people who come to every meeting, who are gonna be part of the HCPC, who are maybe not even people who know what the HAPs are or know about these services, but have some reason that it would be good for them to know about it. And then we can figure out like, where are we missing? What about the communication isn't getting to people and work on addressing those things. So that's sort of a like parallel effort that's being tied in with this community engagement for this first year. Okay. And so we are doing a whole bunch of activities to get input. There's the community engagement events like this one, that where we're sometimes calling this the three questions meeting, because I'm going to give you three questions to respond to as your exercise later. We're also disseminating a survey through these CAP agencies that I showed on the prior slide to their communities. And a similar version of that survey, it's basically the same survey but shorter, to clients of agencies in any of the HAPs, City Clinic, or any HHS, like HIV care sites. They're going to be getting information very shortly to disseminate to help them get the survey out there. The idea is that they basically can post a flyer or hand up on cards that have a QR code on them. So it's very little effort for anybody on the sites. They're just basically letting people know that it exists and encouraging their clients to fill them out. We're also doing another survey that will be going to providers widely, like intended for frontline or client facing providers who can really give input about what their experience is working in the HIV Hep C STI workforce and what they think that clients need and what we need to do. And then we're working with SFDPH to also kind of make sense of the existing contracts, like where is money being spent now, and doing some review of literature that's published in peer-reviewed journals or just on the internet, other things. We're looking for like what are some interesting models, what are some other things that other jurisdictions have tried that San Francisco might want to consider. So all of those things are kind of feeding into this big picture of what are we doing now that's really working that we want to keep, and what are the things that we might want to rethink, reconsider, shift in some way. I think the thing that is really important for me to say, and hopefully for you all to really hear now, is that the timing is unfortunate in a lot of ways because of all of the budget cut stuff that's happening. This was planned in advance of that. And this is not a process designed to identify where the things should be cut. Like, where is it not working? We're going to cut those things. That is not what this process is for. What we're really, the reality is that efforts to address HIV, Hep C, and STIs are facing an increasingly unfriendly environment, right? Both politically and fiscally. And that's the reality. So we are trying to be really thoughtful about how we can take a lead in saying, like, what is our system? What's the stuff that's so important? Like, what makes San Francisco's so good at what we do when it comes to HIV, Hep C, and STIs, and what are our opportunities to really think about how we might want to do things differently that acknowledge that we're in a resource-constrained environment, and we constantly want to be better, right? We constantly want to think and evolve and improve what we're doing, and so it's unfortunate to do that while we're kind of reeling from feeling resource constrained or that things are being taken away. And we want to try to keep this as like a hopeful, proactive process and not just a depressing, reactive process, which is where it feels like so much of our work is these days, right? Okay.
I would just say that I think this is important enough that we won't always be in that kind of unfriendly fiscal environment. And to aim for something is always a good thing. You know, we should always be trying to achieve the goals that we think are the best.
I totally agree. I think, sometimes it's weird to talk about what's happening as a silver lining or as a like opportunity to look at for silver linings. And I think sometimes when there's plenty of money and things are kind of all going our way, it's easy to get a little complacent and just say, yeah, it's all good. But we all know it's not always all good, right? There's all sorts of things that we have been frustrated with over the years or would think could be done differently or should be done differently. And so now, unfortunately, we're being forced to take a hard look at some of those things. But there's a benefit way beyond reacting to the fund cuts. And that's really the space we're trying to continue to hold for this. So I know it's easy to say that and hard to do it, but we're trying really hard. Okay. So the goal is to really come up with a flexible plan, more than was true in the last iteration. We're really trying to not say this is our definitive roadmap, that's exactly what San Francisco is going to do when it comes to HIV, Hep C, and STIs over the next 3 years. We're going to do step one and then step two. But really, like, what are the ways we can be flexible? We can use data to really drive our priorities. We can be prepared so that when new biomedical opportunities present themselves, we're able to really seize that, and we're not constantly like reacting or scrambling to figure out. So that's the goal, and that's part of what we want to hear feedback about, is like, how do we remain more flexible, be prepared so that we can be nimble and do some exciting things when it comes by. Okay. I'm pretty much done, except just to say, I think this is my last slide, to just give you a sense of the timeline. So this is actually a super fast timeline. 6 months may not, or it's not even, it's 5 months, may not even sound like that much, but we need time to actually like synthesize the amount of data we're collecting and come up with a plan that actually makes sense, and to do that by May 31st. And so we are now in this stakeholder engagement and data collection period, which is going for one more month. And we're just like all hands on deck, trying to have as many conversations as possible, pushing the surveys out the door, doing all sorts of things to give people opportunities for feedback. And that'll go for, it's been happening a bit for the last month, and it'll be happening a lot more. And then we'll be working to gather it all, make sense of it, and try to come up with a plan that will really work. Okay, so that's my kind of quick and dirty presentation of what we're doing. Any questions about the stuff I said before we go too much further? Thought that was a question.
Yeah, we stretched.
No questions? Okay. All right. Then what we're going to do is, if you all in the room maybe can't see this very well, that's okay because they're around the room. But we have, as I said, we're sometimes calling it the three questions meeting. So we have three questions for you. And they are around the room. And on during the break on your tables, I put a bunch of post-it notes. And then you should each have a marker, but I have extra post-it notes and markers if anybody needs one. So what I would love for you to do is take much of the, maybe the next 15 or 20 minutes, I think is okay time-wise, and go to the three stations around the room and give us your ideas. So over, now I can't even see which ones are which. Okay, that's the third one. And that's okay. So the first question on this list is over here. And this is really asking what you think are the top priorities. So when you think about San Francisco's system of prevention, care, and treatment for HIV, STIs, and hepatitis C, especially in an era of constrained resources, when you think about like, in at least the near future, things are going to be tight. What's the stuff you think is most important? The absolute top priorities. If we lose these things, we're really undermining San Francisco's model. I want you to write down those things and put them over here on the sheet. Okay. The second question is this silver lining thing, right? So we are in a period of significant disruption, whether we like it or not. So where might there be opportunities to rethink, reinvent, improve, streamline? When you think, because this will make us stronger for the future, to Lee's point, right? If we think about what are the things that we think we should be doing differently, we should rethink and improve now so that we can be even stronger and better in the future. What are those things that you think? I would love to have you put those back in that corner. And then this third one over here, kind of under the speaker, is around what data or information do you all think is most critical for our collective ability to make data-driven decisions about where our limited resources are allocated? And I think this is one that is particularly important for you all as HCPC, because you're used to thinking in that way. So like getting presentations, hearing data and information, and then deciding, okay, given that, what do we do about it? So my question for you for the third one over here is to really say, like, what is that data or information that we think is so important? What's the knowledge you crave to be able to do that kind of role that you do with HCPC? So those are the three questions. Any questions about those.
And you want us to put these on those?
Yes. I want you to actually stick them on the paper because I'm going to take them with me. So you can decide whether you want to wander around and write on your hand or whether you want to sit and then get up and put them all around. I'll give you some time to go ahead and do that. And the people online, I'm going to maybe send you a link and then you can put it in the chat. Or who's the best person to do that? Put it in the chat.
You can put it in the chat.
Okay. All right. So you'll be getting a link momentarily, people online. All right.
Thank you.
Is everybody like close to done? I see a lot of ideas out there. Yeah? Okay. So I'm not trying to rush you at all. Please feel free to keep adding stuff. And for the folks online, I know we just have the link, but I'm going to leave it open. And so I would love for you to keep filling out and get your ideas down. I'm not going to close it immediately or anything. So if you have, so before I close and run out of here, I just want you guys to be able to have my email in case there's anything you didn't ask or say today, didn't get up there, or you want to have more information, feel free to reach out. I'm happy to have communication from any of you. But before I leave, sometimes it's a little weird when you like put ideas up and then people are like, okay, thanks, stop. conversation. So we don't necessarily need to take the time to like go through what everybody said and have a whole thing, but I want to give you an opportunity to like share anything, raise anything that you put up there that you'd like to particularly talk about.
I like the process of the post-it notes. It gives me the opportunity to kind of sit and reflect rather than kind of trying to, in a group, trying to come up with ideas and sharing that. I like this process.
Great. Thank you. Glad to hear that. We're definitely trying all different varieties of, you know, small group, large group, individual, push your ideas on here. And sometimes it's nice, especially at the end of a long day, it's nice to just be able to gather your own thoughts. That's what we
want.
Great.
And I just want to say I appreciate the challenge that you're in at the moment. They're trying to figure out plans for the future and a roadmap and you know, even a very flexible roadmap given the moment that we're in. So thank you for having this. I feel like you are the organization that can tackle this. So I'm glad you're a part of it. But I put it up in some of my post-it notes, but I feel like so much of what the challenge of the moment is protecting what we have, protecting community, protecting what works, protecting public health evidence as it's being thrown out, you know, locally, nationally, everything. And it's hard for me to see how we put that into a plan, because I feel like a plan needs to be sort of hopeful and forward moving. And I feel like, you know, for the last little year, we've all been just like trying to defend everything that we work on. So, yeah, that's not a, I mean, that's just a, I think, sort of acknowledgement of the challenge of the moment. And I appreciate you. That's all I got.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think you said it really well. I think that that's, I know I've certainly been in that space of, like, you know, the defensive posture, like, hands off, don't take this away. We know what we're doing. You know, there's so much of that. And I don't think that's, I think that's the right response to what's happening. And simultaneously, if we dig in and say, like, how it was perfect, it can't be touched or changed, that's also not, I know that's not what you're saying, to be clear. I think that that's also, in some ways, like, undermines our like, credibility as people who are trying to always evolve and do the right thing. And it's really hard to pull those two things together. I struggle with that myself every day. So I really appreciate you saying it. And I'm sure we won't get it perfectly, but we're definitely doing our best to hold both of those things and do them both.
Yeah, I mean, and I feel like it is part of the power of community planning is to be able to move through that cycle of we have information, experience, voices, people's lives. We use that to create plans that we, you know, like being able to iterate through that and continue to come back to the touch point of community. Is this working for the people it's supposed to be working for? And, you know, doing that even in this moment is kind of a way of lifting up community and sort of saying this is, you know, this is why we work, this is who we're here for, and how do we, you know, hold on to that as we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
I also want to say that it's really hard in a resource deficit environment to really focus on the future and thinking, because like Laura said, I'm not trying to protect what we have, but I think it's so critically important to be able to look ahead at a changing environment like the biomedical research, right? How is that going to influence? We have a community that eventually is going to be mostly older HIV people. Almost all of them, if we really get to a point where we can reach getting to zero, right? And so what do we do to take care of those people? It's kind of the shifting priorities of what's about to come, given the landscape of like biomedical advances and things like that. I think it's really important to keep that in mind as we move forward. Yeah.
Any other thoughts, comments, reflections from anyone?
I'll join Laura's sentiment for you, the right person for the job. So to speak, with regards to what the industry is doing with the department, we are building the candidacy with the bigger picture and taking a lot of information. And just valuing the community. Right? So that's part of the obvious agenda, the plan and commitment to that is relevant with regards to the amount of space you'll be in over the next few months, and at the same time, kind of activating all the fear, because those flyers and things that would be pushed out, it would be sent out by a staff, but if you all could help promote people activating either frontline staff or community members, kind of giving information, that's the only way that planning will actually be realistic for renovating the car and being a better report.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's- I wish I had thought to say that. Thank you. I do think, you know, other than your input here and your kind of continued engagement in this work, which I know you're all doing or you wouldn't be here, specifically over the next month, if you are in, you know, a position to see upon cards, encourage someone to scan a QR code and take a survey. I know it often feels like, oh, more survey, one more time, they're going to ask us questions. But if you can push through that and realize, like, if we only get, you know, 50 people to take this survey, we only have so much input, but if we get 500 people to tell us, it's designed to be user-friendly, it's designed to be fast and easy. If we can get, you know, hundreds of people to tell us what they think are needed beyond the normal, you know, the people we always hear from, then the more information we'll have for you all to make decisions, education decisions, and others as we move forward. So definitely, if you can encourage that whenever you see it, that would be really helpful.
And also at the same time, if you want palm cards or posters, Shelly's going to send a bunch to me and easily.
Bring it to the next meeting, Rachel.
That'll be too far away.
Too far away.
Yeah, we're gonna close the surveys on April 1st, so it's soon.
So reach out to me and I'll just anywhere or hello. Again, what we're trying to do is as expansive coverage as possible. So yeah.
Okay.
I think that's it for me. Thank you. We are going to be taking a
look at
your presentation tomorrow.
I'm still
there. Well, I'm about to
Okay, I guess I'm on now. Is that right? I can.
Yes, Mark.
Okay, so let me share my screen. Sorry, I'm not there with you all today. I'm sick. I really wanted to be there for the Burmese food and the cookies, and for you all too. So very sad day for me. Anyway, this is our annual eligibility criteria and severe need and special populations update. So the first box, I think this was passed out, hopefully, as well, so you can have a copy in front of you if you'd like. The first box is for eligibility for Ryan White services overall. And the second box, which is our severe need and special POPs definitions, are for the eligibility and the target client targets of our centers of excellence. So with that said, I'll just read out the first box and point out the difference from last year. The eligibility for Ryan White has to meet all of these bullet points. Be living with HIV. For some family services, such as childcare, there must be an HIV-positive family member. Be considered at risk for HIV for early intervention services only. Live in the EMA, where they are accessing services. Be uninsured or underinsured for the service being provided. Ryan White is a payer of last resort, of course. And have a low income defined as an annual federal adjusted gross income equal to or less than 600% of the federal poverty level. For 2026, that's $15,960, which equals $95,760 for one person. Does anyone have any questions for the eligibility for Ryan White services?
No.
Okay, thank you. Here are the severe need and special POPs definitions. Again, this is for our centers of excellence in particular. To be in the severe need category, an individual must meet all of these bullet points. Disabled by HIV or HIV AIDS or with symptomatic HIV diagnosis, active substance use or mental illness, and then up to the poverty level that is at equal to or less than 150% of FPL. In 2026, that's $15,960 for one person, $21,640 for two people, which does equal $23,940 for one person, and $32,460 for two people. And then the special populations that are targeted by Centers of Excellence are populations with the lowest rates of viral suppression and who experience health disparities. Obviously, that's a very wide-ranging definition, includes multiple communities. Communities with linguistic or cultural barriers to care. Individuals who are being released from incarceration in jails or prisons, or who have a recent criminal justice history. And persons living with HIV age 60 years or older. There's nothing changed on that special pops definition, although you all can, of course, change it. Any questions or comments on the severe need or special populations definitions?
No.
Okay. Moving right along.
Intermittent County, we prioritize some of our clients under 200% federal poverty level, which is what we set because we have our budget for 2% service guidelines. Is that okay? We have to follow the middle column severity. We just say we see the safety net services for people under 200%. Is that allowed?
Sure. Yes. Question.
Only partially. I'm wondering if Bill Bloom is still there. He might be the better person to answer that.
Yeah,
Bill. I'm sorry, I was asking. Can I get a repeat on the question?
Can you, so in Marin County, we specify that some clients under 200% of the federal poverty level have access to safety net services, such as family, food vouchers, et cetera. We don't offer it to everyone, but it's 200% because we define it as we look at our budget and we want to offer it to these many people. Is that okay? We don't call them the severe need, we just say we are including this.
So, you know, the severe need population isn't meant to be exclusive of other populations. It just means it's the special populations of focus. So how you as a sister county want to operationalize it, as long as you're not excluding people, but managing your specific population. So there's, just to be clear, you qualify for the service or you don't qualify for the service. So it has clients. So this is more just to say where we want people to focus their service and their system design. So that's where you find.
Great, thank you.
Any
more questions? Okay, no questions.
Any public comment?
It's just Sally.
No question.
Okay, can I hear a motion to submit this as our updated eligibility criteria?
I so move. This is Lee Jewell.
Second.
There's a second. Okay, this does involve money, so this does require a roll call vote. Can I ask Kira or Kat, if I assume one of them is there, to do a roll call vote for this updated eligibility criteria?
Kat's on it.
John Gavin?
Yes.
Leroy?
Yes.
Yes. Ellingsworth?
Yes.
Ron Hernandez?
Yes.
Ido?
Yes.
Thomas Noble?
Yes.
Nali?
Yes.
Jeremy?
Jeremy.
Reverend
Brown?
Yes.
J.P.
Soto?
Yes.
Laura Thomas?
Yes.
Passes.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Oh, you're all little groups. Huh, just noticed that.
So we have Huntsman and Frank. Next meeting is going to be Monday, March 23rd, and we are. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, is that what you're doing?
No.
We were talking to you.
That's what you're doing.
It might have been.